This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, here with you on DAB across the country, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. Every weekday from 9 until midday, sharing ideas about money. I'm joined in the studio by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss from the financial website Of The Year to talk through some of the stories that they've been working on this week. And on the agenda today, we'll be focusing on two big things us Brits really don't like to talk about: death and maths. First up, it's wills and the rising number of disputes over inheritance.
We've seen a 600% increase in new inquiries in the last 4 years. The tightening of purse strings has caused some, perhaps, to take drastic measures to procure inheritance.
And Simon will tackle the eighth wonder of the world. That's according to Einstein, and who are we to disagree with him? Compounding. And why brushing up on our math skills is crucial for our finances.
Knowing the principles is important. Percentages, be able to calculate the interest rates on your bank account. It doesn't matter if you have to reach for your calculator, but as long as you know how the calculations work.
We talk property and ask, is there trouble in paradise? Sellers beware. Is it worth paying off your mortgage quickly? And Nationwide's plans to enable homeowners to help their kids get on the property ladder, so they can finally move out.
There's just no way that on like a wage of like say 20, even 25k, like which I'm nowhere near on at the moment, I don't even think I could afford to put a deposit down.
Is renting out your spare room a win-win all round? Well, there are things to look out for, especially with Airbnb.
A fire burns down the house, the insurance won't pay, and then the mortgage lender won't be able to come after you for the money. You won't have it, and there's no asset for them to take and resell.
Also today, watch out, Simon takes on councils over parking again. And getting ready to head off on holiday, we help you navigate the minefield that could be tipping abroad. So on that theme, I want to know, what sort of tipper are you? A very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Rachel. What sort of tipper are you, Simon?
Hello, Georgie. I'm not a compulsive tipper, as in I don't feel compelled to tip on all occasions. And I think this is quite an interesting thing that this article flagged, because it talked about tipping in all the different countries around Europe. And I have long pointed out to people that, for example, in France, for example, English people will just automatically add 10%, or better, add 10% on. But France has this thing called service compris, so the tip is already in there. And I think this is also the thing that catches people out with the service charges that are included in the UK, where it's on the bill, you don't see it, but you tip as well. So I will check for that. But I do tend to tip. You know, I tip 10%, 15%, and if it's really good service, I'll tip more.
Watch out if you're a bar in America and you don't tip. You'll be nursing your tap water all evening.
I was sat in a bar in America last December with some friends, and we'd been drinking there for an hour and a half or so. Sat at that classic in New York, sat at the bar kind of thing. We settled up the bill at the end. And as we settled it up and we left, I said, we did leave a tip, didn't we? Because we wouldn't have been popular with the waitress who'd been looking after us for quite some time.
You would not be invited back. I remember the good old days, Rachel, when you tipped someone who did exceptional service. We are seeing more of the French-style system here, aren't we? What are your views? What sort of tipper are you?
I suppose I'd define myself as a typically British tipper. Awkward, socially uncomfortable and probably inconsistent. I can navigate bars, restaurants, but there are some that really stump me every time. Hairdresser. Just don't know what you're supposed to do. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't, but either way I feel uncomfortable because I don't know what you're supposed to do or what the correct amount is.
Taxis, beauticians. It's a minefield out there.
Here at Share Radio, we have been debating the Brexit referendum, bringing you the latest views from the world of business, finance and politics.
It isn't really just a question of whether we have a recession in 4 or 6 months or a year. It's where we're going to be in 20 years' time, 40 years' time, 50 years' time.
We've curated all our Brexit interviews and put them in one place
to help you make an informed decision on the 23rd of June.
Just go to audioboom.com
and type in Brexit Special on Share Radio. do indeed. A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. This is Share Radio, the team from This Is Money, live in the studio with me, joined today by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss from the financial website of the year in partnership with NS&I. And coming up, trouble in paradise as housing prices finally start hitting their ceiling, maybe. But first, I'm going to start by talking about something, as I said earlier, we Brits really don't like to talk about. That is death, unsurprisingly. More specifically, we're going to be talking about wills and inheritance and the rise in the number of people going to court to dispute them. Now, the blame, well, it's being laid at the door of rising house prices. Here's Roman Kubiak, partner in the Contested Wills Trust and Estate Department at law firm Hugh James.
There are four key grounds on which you can challenge a will. There's lack of mental capacity, lack of knowledge and approval, fraud and undue influence. And what's happening is, I think there's been a perfect storm recently. Four key factors which have really led to this rise. I think those are, firstly, the economic downturn. So people have chosen either not to make wills to cut costs, make homemade wills, which lead to ambiguity and questions to be asked, or to take perhaps the cheaper option in the market, which may not be tailored to their needs. There's obviously the modern family dynamic has changed very much to what it was, say, a generation ago. So you have second marriages, which are very common now, and many couples foregoing marriage altogether. The law, sadly, is struggling to keep up with this modern family dynamic.
Who has a right to contest a will? Is it fair game?
No, it's not fair game. I mean, really, there are a number of categories of people. Firstly, there is anyone who benefited under an earlier will. So really, the law is there to protect these people if, say, something untoward has happened. So, for instance, we have cases and personally, my own experience, we've seen a 600% increase in new inquiries in the last 4 years. And I think what's happening is the tightening of purse strings has caused some, perhaps, to take drastic measures to procure inheritance.
600% increase. So if you can contest a will, what is the point in writing one? Here's finance guru Lindsay Cook from Money Fight Club.
Nearly two-thirds of adults in this country have not made a will, according to Citizens Advice. Most of them think that they haven't got anything worth leaving. I spoke to somebody last night who owns a perfectly good house in Sussex, and she said, oh, but our affairs are very simple. And I said, do you realise you've got children? Under the intestacy rules, if your house is worth more than £250,000, the children would get half of the money over £250,000. You might have to sell your home if you don't treat your children well. But if you want things to go to the people you want, if you want to decide who's going to look after your children if they are under a certain age, if you are on your second marriage, if you've got stepchildren, there are so many reasons why. Even children who have never married but have made a few things, get it sorted out, because do you know what? It goes to your parents if you die without making a will. It doesn't automatically go to your siblings.
You said intestacy rules. What do you mean by that? What is intestacy?
Intestacy is when you haven't made a valid will and rules come in this country which say who will get the money. If you're married and you haven't got anybody else, then it goes to them. But if you've got children, that makes it complicated.
That was Lindsay Cook there. Now, while there are plenty of legitimate cases to contest wills, I imagine all of them have one thing in common, and they are pretty unpleasant. But the next case, an account from one of your readers, is particularly nasty, it seems, Rachel. Give us a little bit more detail about that, if you would.
It is pretty grisly. So a reader got in touch with us who claimed that they had an elderly relative who'd passed away sometime before then, had a will that had split up their assets between four family members. But then, to the surprise of these family members, one turned up who used to be a solicitor, encouraged the now deceased to put all of her assets into his wife's name and to name him as the executor. So the question was, what can be done? Can it be contested? The whole thing sounds, if the reader is to be believed on all of this, it sounds quite awful that there was a quick funeral without family members being notified with enough notice, and the house cleared out and family stuff sent to auction.
I mean, that's a real tragedy, all of this nastiness around it. But you did get an expert to go in more detail, and you looked at things like what makes a will valid or invalid, undue influence, mental capacity. What is the general advice here, though? I imagine everyone would say speak to a solicitor first and foremost.
Precisely, and there are a few grounds on which a will can be challenged, so long as you're one of the people who is able to do so. You can't just be, you know, a friend who turns up who thinks perhaps they ought to have been left apart. You have to be a family member or, you know, have a close connection with the deceased. But it can be challenged on grounds of mental capacity, undue influence, which in the case of this particular reader, there may be a case since it was a solicitor who sort of meddled later on. Was he the one who drew out the will? We don't know. But could he have had undue influence potentially if he did draw up the will and it was all put into the name of his wife? Well, there's an issue there that could be explored as well.
All very troubling, all very difficult as well, particularly things like mental capacity of the testator, the person whose will it is. That's always going to be a tough one, particularly if you are old when you're drawing up your will. I suppose it highlights the importance of, well, get on top of your will as soon as you can.
I suppose that's it. And I mean, when we think about what we own, most of us, I think, will think, oh, there's not very much and it's all very straightforward. But then there are all these sorts of, we get sort of wills experts getting in touch with us all the time asking us whether we want to write something about, I don't know what they call it, your sort of cyber possessions. So if you've got a massive online library of music, or, I mean, what do you want to happen
digital
to
digital property
to,
almost,
that's
isn't it?
It's your digital possessions. What do you want to happen to sort of all your social media stuff? Mm. Do you want someone to have some kind of influence over that? But it all comes down to the same issue, doesn't it, that no one really likes to think about when they're going to die.
Don't like to think about it. We don't like to talk about death. So I'm wondering, is that why, Simon, that two-thirds of us, according to Citizens Advice, haven't written a will? Does that figure surprise you? It seems quite high to me.
Two-thirds of us plus one, actually. I don't have one.
Goodness me.
No,
why
so
that?
There you go. So the figure doesn't surprise me at all, because I know how important it is and I know that I should have one. And it's just something that I've never, ever got around to doing, which is crazy, really, because there is a situation where you could actually just write something on a piece of paper, you know, and you get, it has to be in writing and signed by the testator. So signed by me in the presence of two witnesses who were present at the same time. They must be independent, so neither the witness nor their spouse can be a beneficiary of the will. Mm. So I could write one on a piece of paper here and you two could sign it as witnesses. And then at least it would say, if I die, I leave everything to my wife. And if my wife doesn't survive me, I leave everything equally to my children. And then at least that just lays out the most basic bit of my will. But then I've never done it because I've not been to see a solicitor or a will writer. You know, you just like, I need to do that, I need to do that. You don't find the time. If you don't do it at certain life points, I think, for example, when you buy a house, when you get married, then it's one of those things that falls by the wayside. And it is really important, and it is something that people should do. It's something that I should do.
Obviously, I don't recommend you write it on a piece of paper, but is it ever worth DIYing it, Rachel?
As Simon says, a piece of paper is better than nothing at all. Something, you know, that you get down at Smith's is better than that again. When things get a little bit more complicated, then you probably want to get a solicitor on board. But, I mean, it's better than nothing. It's worth doing.
I'm curious to know what you think, Simon, as well, about the rise in the number of contested wills. We were hearing earlier that this could be down to rising house prices, but do you think there could be something else at play here as well?
I think it's down to more and more people writing them live on air in radio studios.
So?
Yeah, and then just getting the people on the air to sign them. Mm-hmm. Just to go on what Rachel said there, you could write it yourself, but if you were doing anything more complicated than what I just talked about, as in that I leave everything to my wife, and if she doesn't survive me, I leave it to my kids. The moment you start having things like who's going to look after your kids, whether you've got any form of inheritance tax issue, if you do leave everything to your kids, if your spouse or partner doesn't survive you, do you want it to be held in a way that means that the person who's looking after them can access the money? Once you get to that point, you can't just write that on the back of a piece of paper and get two people to sign it.
And also there's more complications now with family life, second marriages,
etc. It is more complicated. And what complicates it greatly is the fact that people have more assets. I mean, for example, there's many more people who've been pulled into the inheritance tax bracket. It's still a minority, but it's a growing minority. And once you start straying into that, it starts making a real difference as to whether you leave things to your children or you leave things to your spouse, because you can pass money between husband and wife or civil partners or husband and wife free of inheritance tax. But you know, if you don't do that, if you've got a surviving spouse and then you leave it to your children, you can't double up the inheritance tax threshold. But there's another thing that's important to bear in mind, actually, which is approaching this from the other angle, which is what happens if you get left something in a will that you don't want? So you can do this. There is a thing called a deed of variation, which all of the parties who are beneficiaries of the will have to agree to.
And now, would this be that you wanted it to go to somewhere else? Because surely if you got given a house, you could just sell it.
You could do. But say, for example, you were in the position where you were someone in their, you know, 50s, 60s, and your last surviving parent dies. And you would rather that your share of their house goes to your children, that it doesn't go to you. You don't ever want to see that money because it causes you an inheritance tax problem. Yeah. Well, in some cases, you know, people don't want to leave it to the grandchildren. They feel they have to be fair to their children, and so they will leave it to their children. But you can do something called a deed of variation, for example, where you could say, I don't want that. I don't want what I've been left by my parent. I want it to go to my children. And you can basically effectively divert, you know, the beneficiaries of the will down a different path, as long as everybody agrees. And again, you need to speak to a solicitor about that. And that's something that is happening more and more, and is again largely to do with this issue of rising property prices, meaning that people end up with more money than they thought.
I'm going to ask you something, Simon, a very uncomfortable question. Broadly, how much do you think millennials are relying on inheritance after their parents and grandparents have died nowadays? How much are we existing on that mentality?
Maybe quite a bit. There's plenty of studies that, you know, where they've asked people this question. And so I think a lot of people do. I think a lot of people think, oh, well, at some point I'm going to get this money, or I'm going to get this share of a house. And I think it's definitely more of a thing for people who live in the south of Britain, London, the southeast especially, but also the south of Britain, those places where house prices are higher, where, you know, it's not necessarily that house prices are a higher multiple of earnings, because if you go, you know, up north, for example, where house prices are lower, earnings are lower as well. But actually, if you look at that actual monetary gap, the monetary gap in, you know, those high house price areas is absolutely huge. And there are people looking at the situation going, I do not know how I will ever be able to afford the same kind of house in the same kind of location that my parents lived in without having some of their money.
Rachel, your view?
It may be the case, but it's absolutely not the fault of millennials that they're in this predicament. Their parents or grandparents will have, by no sort of virtue of their own efforts necessarily, benefited from this huge boom in house prices, which won't be seen by millennials. It's not that sort of millennials are just slobbing around waiting for this money to come to them, whereas their parents or grandparents worked so hard to get onto the property ladder, and, you know, it's their blood, sweat and tears that they're hoping to receive from their relatives. They cannot have that same kind of leap in wealth that's required to buy property that was enjoyed by their parents and grandparents.
Well, let's focus on some better news in this area. We'll stick to that theme. And it seems, well, you don't have to die to enable your kids or grandkids to get on the property ladder. Hurrah! Nationwide Building Society is looking at ways to revolutionise the mortgage market by developing products to let homeowners help their children and release value in their properties as they grow old to help bolster retirement savings. Now, it could also mean the growing band of boomerang kids can finally move out. We're hearing so-called multi-generational households have increased by almost a half in the past decade as property prices have risen by around the same amount. 24-year-old Charlotte Nisbet is from Romford and spoke to us of her experiences.
I'm living with my boyfriend Jay in his parents' house, and we've been living there since September. So we moved in there because we tried to move outside of London and we just couldn't afford it. And plus the train fare to get into London where we both work was just crazy. So Jay's parents let us live with him for sort of as long as we need to save up some money so that we can finally move out. We did originally want to move into London, but then we realised that we just can't. I don't think that is something that is achievable for us. I think we're going to have to look at buying in Romford or even further out into Essex. Everybody's trying to save up to move out, and everyone's like in couples and sort of everyone's just trying to skimp together as much money as they can. But I think everybody's just as skint as each other, really. I feel like it's going to be a long time coming. There's just no way that on like a wage of like, say, 20, even 25k,
like which I'm nowhere near on at the moment, I don't even think I could afford to put a deposit down. We're really lucky because Jay's parents are really chilled, but it would be nice, you know, to have our own space and to have like things how we like them to be. You do kind of have to adapt to other people's rules in a lot of ways. But, you know, overall, we're really, really lucky.
Well, that was Charlotte there from Romford. Now, with rents rising so fast, is it a surprise more adult kids are heading back to live with their folks? Here's Valerie Bannister, Head of Lettings at Your Move.
I think it would be fair to say, if you're a tenant listening to this show, what it means year on year to you is about an average of £19 extra a month that you're paying in rent. And yes, out of your net income, you're paying more into your rental. And just to put that into perspective, in central London, you know, 40% of your net income will likely be on your rental. And in fact, the research shows that some tenants will pay up to 50% if the property is right for them, you know, it's right by the tube station or where they have to get to work. But conversely, we've seen second to those regions, the South East area has still seen some rent increases. And I think that supports that the people are trying to move out of London if they can, as it's slightly more affordable.
Now, Nationwide ruled out lifting borrowing limits to 100% of the value of the property, but it did, of course, recently increase the age at which it will allow mortgages to be repaid from 75 to 85. So somewhat exactly a Nationwide planning. Do we have any more details? How do they fit in with the bigger scheme of things?
Well, there's a couple of different issues at play here. And one of them is this issue of more people who basically haven't paid off their mortgage until quite late in life. So you've got this issue of interest-only mortgages. There was a huge boom in interest-only mortgages from about 2000 onwards. But even before then, there was people with interest-only mortgages and endowment policies that didn't pay out what they should have paid out. And so you've got people who are reaching 65 and haven't paid off their mortgage. And so they need their mortgage to continue on for longer. You've also got this phenomenon that's been referred to as silver splitters, where their people are breaking up, divorcing in their 60s. And they could probably, but they need two properties now, but they need a mortgage to buy one. Probably only a really small mortgage, but up until now you've had banks saying, no, we won't lend beyond retirement age, even though they might have provable earnings in the form of, you know, a final salary pension or something that would comfortably cover the mortgage. You've also got a scenario where basically we went completely bananas for about 7 years and pulled a load of money out of our houses to cash in on their rising value, which is what led to all those consecutive quarters of economic growth under a certain Mr. Gordon Brown, as we all splashed out by cashing in on our houses. That's one side of it. But then on the other side of it, you've got what Rachel was just talking about here. You've basically got this scenario where you've got one generation with this large amount of property wealth built up due to the stratospheric rise in property prices over the last 30 years. And then you've got another generation who has no hope of ever being able to buy those properties without some form of assistance. And it's certainly, like Rachel was saying, it's not the millennials' fault. But then also you have to reflect on the fact that those people, for example, who do have those houses worth all of that money, it's not really of any great benefit to them unless they either sell up and cash in by moving somewhere completely different, away from their family and their friends where they don't want to live, which then, of course, causes a problem for all those other people in that part of the country where it's cheaper and all these people come in with all the money, or they die. And dying is rarely considered to be beneficial for someone. So, you know, and they've got this curse where, as a parent, you want your children to have a good life, to have a better life than you've had. That is a fundamental desire as a parent. You want your children to have a good life, to provide a good life for them, but you want them to go on to have a better standard of living than you had. And the curse of high house prices in you know, the South, London, the South East, all of those places, is that you have parents who are looking at their children in their 30s who have good jobs, well-paying jobs, who've worked very, very hard, and the curse of it is that they could never afford to buy the kind of a very modest home in their own home location. So now you've got this generation trying to pass money in an unprecedented fashion to the younger generation. Now, if you're lucky and you've got a big pile of cash, then you can hand over some cash to your kids. And also, that's a great way to avoid inheritance tax. You survive for 7 years, there's no inheritance tax. But if most of your wealth is built up in your house, well, then the only way that you can pass the money on to the kids is by selling the house. Now, understandably, there's quite a lot of people out there who are quite attached to the place that they live in, especially if it's somewhere they've lived for the last 20 or 30 years. So whilst they would like to give money to their children, they don't want to sell the house. So Nationwide hasn't given exact details of what it's talking about, but what it seems to be talking about is some form of scheme where people could somehow cash into that money by taking out a mortgage rather than an equity release scheme.
What would be the difference?
They would then
there?
Give that money to their kids, and their kids could then go out and buy. But of course, you'd have this scenario where basically people would appear to now have a mortgage for the whole of their life. Yeah. It was never paid off. You sort of like, you went from a point where it was big down to a point where it was little, and then went back up to a point where it was big again. The difference between this and equity release would probably be that there would be lower rates, because it would be more like a mortgage, and mortgage rates tend to be lower than equity release, and also that you would probably be paying some form of interest at the very least, so that you weren't having that amount that you owed roll up and roll up and roll up.
Well, just giving some stats to you, I mean, house prices, according to Nationwide's own data, rising almost 5% in the last year. The average age of first-time buyers going up from 31.5 to 31.9 in the last 12 months. I'm wondering, though, Rachel, and we're talking about the older generation, the millennials, but now that we heard this week the FCA announcing a ban on exit fees for pensions, which may perhaps have stopped many over 55s accessing the new pension freedoms, and now this we're hearing, are we in danger, and I don't mean this in a patronising way at all, but of perhaps giving too much responsibility too quickly to individuals without sufficient advice, and the bank of mum and dad could well run dry for themselves in their own retirement?
There's two real issues here. There's one that goes back to what we were talking about with wills, people not wanting to think about death, but specifically not wanting to think about how long they're going to live for. That's really a very difficult thing to do, but also essential when you're planning for your retirement, especially if you're kind of thinking about if you could apportion anything to children or grandchildren, thinking about what you're going to have left for yourself and whether that's enough to live on. And that's one point. And then there's the sort of emotional one as well, which is that, as Simon says, it must be very difficult if you're asset rich, but don't necessarily have readies, and kids who you want to see settled, not to be able to give them money. As well, people living a lot longer, so people will wait longer for the funds that they might need to buy their own property. So what we're seeing is all of these sort of innovative products coming up, bubbling up from the surface. There was one from Barclays as well, to help parents support their children in buying property, but not necessarily giving them the money. And then we've got this one from Nationwide as well. And we'll see more and more of these. My fear over this, while it makes perfect sense to be able to help transfer wealth in this way, is that we keep talking about house prices being inflated, and we sort of talk about bubbles in the southeast, certainly. The Nationwide figures this week also showed that the average price of a property is about 10 times the average income that a first-time buyer has. This is utterly unsustainable, we say, and yet it is sustained by every new product that we have that makes it possible. So for prices to be able to moderate, we have to sort of stop coming up with innovative solutions for people to be able to get around it. Selfishly, that would be a difficult thing to justify, but sort of looking at the housing market as a whole and what will happen sort of in the much longer term, we need some kind of solution that isn't just about finding, you know, these products from Nationwide and from Barclays. We had another one a couple of weeks ago that helped you anticipate an imagined income that you might have from a lodger and for that to be factored in to your income when you're looking to buy a property. Then we've got things like Help to Buy from the government, which is effectively allowing house buyers to hedge on property prices with the help of the government. That's great, and that sort of keeps the status quo, and helps people who are really struggling to get on the housing market, but it also pushes up prices.
Well, talking about house prices, we'll talk about lodges in a few short moments, but talking about house prices, on your website here, Trouble in Paradise, National Estate Agency boss warns of a big slump in buyers after buy-to-let rush. House prices have hit a ceiling. Sellers beware. We're also reading today a number of first-time buyers hit a two-year high in April.
The ceiling is about, surely we must run out of people who can pay these sorts of prices. Surely we must run out of people who have the funds from parents or from other means to be able to buy. But if you keep pushing up this ceiling through all these innovations, then not necessarily. And it's true that we get sort of a plethora of housing statistics every month. And we're in a bit of an awkward position right now because we had this boom caused by the changes in the buy-to-let stamp duty rules, which meant that there was a big scramble to buy property, and now we might see a sort of slowdown as a result of that. It's inevitable. So those numbers are skewed. It's harder to sort of see definitive patterns around that. Plus, there are other things like Brexit that people talk about, and that creates all sorts of uncertainty as well. And what will that will do to foreign investors, foreign buyers, and what impact that will have. So it's sort of difficult to call it either way on housing stats, I think, this month and probably for the next couple.
Simon, I want to come back to you. You mentioned there, could we be moving towards a scenario where you have a mortgage that exists forever? Indeed, you've written your article here. Is it still worth paying off your mortgage as soon as you can? Terms getting longer to mitigate these sky-high prices Rachel's been talking about for home prices. Some lenders seeing a growing trend of 40-year mortgages. What prompted you to ask this question of yourself, I think it is?
Yeah, I wrote my column on this week. Well, it was kind of actually triggered by the nationwide news and some of the stuff we've done around lenders extending mortgage terms, but also around this idea of super low interest rates as well. So basically paying off your mortgage as soon as you can has been this cornerstone of financial wisdom for a very, very long time. You know, the idea is that basically what you should do is you should avoid extending the term at all costs. So, you used to take out your mortgage for 25 years. And when you move, instead of moving and taking out a new mortgage that's 25 years again, you stick to maybe the 19 years you've got down to. And also this idea of overpaying your mortgage, which basically a little can go quite a long way with this. You know, you overpay by £100 a month and it can save you tens of thousands of pounds in the end and get your mortgage cleared quite a bit earlier. So it's like, is this still worth doing? So just to put the figures into context here, if you've got a £150,000 repayment mortgage at a steady 3.5%, over 40 years, in total, it'll cost you £279,000. But over 25 years, it'll cost you £225,000. So you shave £170 off your monthly mortgage payments by taking that longer term. And that's why mortgage lenders are getting people to do this. It's this kind of weird, perverse way of dealing with mortgage affordability, which is make it more affordable at the short-term monthly level, but end up paying over £50,000 more for the cost of the mortgage over its lifetime. But if you flip that around and you overpay by £170 a month, then you save £21,500 in total and you get the mortgage cleared in just over 18 years. So if you're a 35-year-old first-time buyer, you'll be mortgage-free by the age of 53 for £85 a month if you buy as a couple, which sounds like quite a good deal, doesn't it? But then there is this question. Interest rates are super low. Does it still make sense to do this? Am I right to have an offset mortgage, be balancing my savings against it, saving into it, which is effectively overpaying every month, with the hope that I get that mortgage cleared sooner than it should be? Or should I be going out and borrowing as much money as I can, all guns blazing, to get the biggest possible house while mortgage rates are low and super cheap? I mean, it sounds daft and it sounds like a deeply unsensible move, especially as someone who thinks that property is hugely overvalued in this country. But then I do ask myself this question of, I'm looking at this over a 3 or 4 year horizon. I'm looking at this over the next, I've got 17 years left on my mortgage, 17 years. Over that 17 years, that property price problem should right itself. I shouldn't end up down. So should I be borrowing loads more money? So I asked our readers, is it worth paying off your mortgage as soon as possible? And we got an overwhelming yes with 86% of the votes, which was 1,464 people, and no from 14%. So I still err on the side of paying off my mortgage, and it appears so do most of our readers. And in an interesting insight into people who read financial websites early in the morning, it was much more skewed towards the yes, pay it off soon, yesterday morning at 8:30. So there you go, the early bird pays off their mortgage.
There you go, and there is more maths to come as well.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever.
wherever.
But before then, so now may not be the right time to sell, perhaps to get the most money you can from your property. Nationwide plans still to be thrashed out and rents are rising. Could the perfect solution be more people renting out their spare room? A lodger could help, of course, pay off that mortgage even quicker as well. But while London is known as the priciest region in the UK, there are other places in the country where room rents are increasing much quicker, 5% on average compared to 1.63% in the capital. Now, that's according to spareroom.co.uk. And the government has helped out homeowners further in this regard. Here's Share Radio's Ed Bowsher.
The rent-a-room allowance is a great tax break. The limit has been raised dramatically. It was £4,250 a year. It's now £7,500. That means you can rent out a room in your home as long as it's your main home. You don't even have to own the home as long as you're the resident landlord. And as long as you don't charge any more than £7,500 to the tenant, it's tax-free. You can't rent out a separate flat under this scheme. The room has to be furnished. It could even be a floor as long as it's within the main home. It doesn't have a separate door or anything like that.
Well, the government's also helped out avid Airbnbers. From April next year, you can earn up to £1,000 completely tax-free. But watch out, as you may be breaking your mortgage agreement in the process. Here's award-winning financial journalist Donna Ferguson.
The mortgage lenders are very concerned about Airbnb because it's, for them, a relatively new thing. They like to know exactly how the mortgage is going to be repaid, because that's how they calculate their risk. And they've based their decision to lend to you on the fact that you'll be living in the home and you'll be earning money and paying the mortgage from your income. Now, when they do a buy-to-let mortgage, that's a completely different scenario. In that scenario, they're basing their decision to lend on the income that you receive from your tenant. So Airbnb for them is a bit confusing because it falls between the two. You know, to some extent, you're living in the home, but you're also renting out your home. They're worried that perhaps you haven't got the full insurance that you should have. So, for example, if you don't inform your buildings insurer, then it could invalidate your buildings insurance. And then if a fire burns down the house, the insurance won't pay. And then the mortgage lender won't be able to come after you for the money because you won't have it and there's no asset for them to take and resell. So that's a problem for them. They also worry that potentially they might not be able to get the tenant out. So say you go away on holiday, your tenant decides to live in your home forever and you stop paying the mortgage, they don't have any rights potentially to get the tenant out.
OK, so lots to think about there. But Rachel, on your website, find out how much rent your spare room could make you, and it's not London seeing the fastest rises. So where in the country are seeing the fastest rises?
Yeah, across the UK, they're going up. I suppose that's inevitable, isn't it, with house prices as they are and rents increasingly unaffordable. East Midlands and Anglia looks like it's seen a particular boost in the past year, and the North East as well. We have to remember that these numbers are from spareroom.co.uk, mm-hmm. which does have a huge number of people signed up, but it is sort of, it will only be people who have signed up to that website that will see the numbers through. But I'm all into this. It's such a good deal. And so long as you charge less than, it's £625 a month is what the £7,500 works out as per month. So long as you're charging less than that, you don't even have to think about tax. And it is a good way of, we talk about there not being sufficient housing stock. This seems to me a really good solution.
I'm wondering, Simon, another nail in the coffin for buy-to-let landlords, though?
Maybe. I mean, people have had lodgers for years, haven't they? And it didn't seem to stop buy-to-let taking off. This is actually a great tax break, as Rachel just said. That's £625 a month. If you were a basic rate taxpayer, that's about 800 quid. If you're a higher rate taxpayer, that's a grand a month that you could get, you know, the equivalent of that you'd have to earn. So you'd have to earn £12,000 to get the equivalent of that. And, I mean, these figures show that even in the West Midlands, average room rents are about £400 a month, which, you know, the West Midlands is not an expensive place for property. That's quite a lot of money. You know, that would make a difference to somebody's, you know, household income. Mm. And I mean, it would be a great way of getting some money in and then saving it into a pension or something, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it indeed? About £747 a month in London, £280 a month in Northern Ireland.
I have a friend who has a Monday to Friday lodger. This is genius. He's never home. They never see each other. She's not home in the evenings either, and she gets the place to herself at the weekend. He doesn't pay less because it's Monday to Friday, because that is also quite a desirable offering. And people who want the Monday to Friday deal tend to be sort of, you know, professionals who are working someplace, have family another. It works out like a dream.
Before we get too carried away, though, there are lots of things to consider, I imagine. And we heard Donna Ferguson there talking about, think about who you tell, your lender, etc., what you say.
Exactly. Your lender, home insurance as well, you have to be careful of, make sure that everything is covered there. But, I mean, it doesn't have to be that big a deal, really. If you're going to be doing it over the long term, if you can have an Airbnb every now and again, perhaps it's not worth it. But if you are thinking about having someone renting a room over the longer term, so long as you do it properly, a few obstacles at the beginning, and then you get on with it.
Simon?
You should also think about your lodger. I mean, you know, like, do some checks on them. Try and get some references from them. Try and get some kind of proof that they are a person of sound character and not going to murder you in your bed, which is very unlikely. I don't think many lodgers do that, but it is worth checking up on these things.
Always is, Simon, yeah. Just double check they're not going to murder you in your bed. Goodness me. Editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. I thought we'd got death out the way, Simon, but we're going to move on. We're going to talk about maths. Now, bear with me, everyone. We're hearing some rather worrying stats about how little we know, how little confidence we have, that we're lacking in the basic skills. It's not just impacting our lives, but that of our kids. Physicist Melanie Windridge told us it's not good enough.
60% of adults are unable to help children with their homework. People are not very confident about maths at all. 7 in 10 people have difficulty working out a budget, and 18% of Brits are avoiding math of any kind because they have such a lack of confidence. We should just increase our confidence and maybe start doing more day-to-day math things, like playing card games or doing math puzzles, and small things like that can really help. Maths is becoming increasingly important in jobs now, particularly in the digital world in which we live. There is so much call for math skills and data skills. I think a lot of times people forget that it's important because they think, I'll never need maths in my day-to-day life. And they forget that they are using it day-to-day. For example, adding up shopping bills or figuring out how long a journey is going to take. I think that knowing the principles is important. For example, have a grasp of percentages or be able to calculate the interest rates on your bank account, for example. So it doesn't matter if you have to reach for your calculator to actually do the sums, but as long as you know how the calculations work and you're familiar with those kind of things.
So there you go. That was physicist Melanie Windridge talking about our lack of confidence and skills in maths. So This Is Money are here to help. And we're going to focus specifically now on one of your favourite topics, Simon, but what Albert Einstein called the 8th wonder of the world. Yes, compounding. And you have a definitive guide to unlocking the massive benefits of compound interest. But Simon, I think you've done quite a lot of maths today. So drawing the short straw is Rachel. You've got 90 seconds to explain what is compounding and why it's so important. Your time starts now.
Compounding is your best friend if you've got a bit of money. If you've got debt, probably your worst enemy. But the basic premise behind it is if you the interest that you accumulate, you get interest on. Plus you get the interest on that. I haven't explained that very well at all. Imagine you've got £100 in a bank account and you get interest on it, let's say generously 10%. I mean, good luck to you. But say you've got 10%. So then at the end of that year, you'll have £110. But then this is where it gets jammy. After the next year, you get not interest on the £100 that you had in the first place, but you get interest on the £110. And this starts to grow in an exponential fashion. And we have the most beautiful graph, though I say so myself, in this article that we've done. We've broken it down to make it easier through two sisters called Prudence and Extravaganza. And Prudence decided to start saving early. She started saving a little bit every month from the age of 18. But then she thought, do you know what? I've done enough after the age of 38. She'd done it for 20 years. And she stopped saving completely. Her sister Extravaganza had a lovely time from the age of 18 to 38, and she went out and was awfully profligate and went and spent all her money. But then when she got to 38, she thought, goodness, Prudence done rather well. Perhaps I should do that as well. So Extravaganza started to put aside the same amount of money that Prudence was and got this, and was getting the same returns that Prudence was. But she only started saving at 38. And she saved from 38 to 68, still did not have the same amount of money as Prudence, because that saving that you do earlier on has the benefit of compound interest over more and more years, and so the value increases without you having to raise a finger. It's incredible. The sooner you can start saving, the better, is the message from compounding. The other way around as well. If you're in debt, the amount of debt that you're in, if you don't pay it off, will just start to spiral in exactly the same fashion, and you can end up in a huge amount of debt when you just started with a very little.
I think that might have been a bit over 90 seconds, but I'll let you off. It can be quite complicated. The number and the figure that I think people are interested in, it's at the end when both a 60 extravaganza you talk about accumulated just 80,000 compared with her sister's half a million. Well, from compounding to another of Simon's favourite subjects, and that is parking. This is Money reporting UK councils have increased the cost of resident parking permits by an average of 51% since 2011. The average permit price is £64 a year across most of the UK. But some people are paying 10 times that amount, and surprisingly, it's not the capital that's the most expensive. Where? Well, a resident's permit in part of Birmingham costs a whopping £785. Simon, your time has come again. Councils and parking permits, but it's not Islington this time. The floor is yours. Go.
No, I mean, it is Islington as well. It's just Birmingham charges
obviously,
a bit more.
Obviously,
yeah.
Obviously.
Do you want to know my favourite thing about the Birmingham permit? So it costs £785 a year. Do you know what that permit entitles you to? It doesn't actually even entitle you to park.
Oh.
So the annual resident permit for use in the pay and display bays from 5 p.m. to 9 a.m. and all day Saturday and Sunday, £785. So for your £785, you could park between the hours of 5 p.m. and 9 a.m. and all day Saturday and Sunday. But it doesn't actually get you the right to park by your home if you live in right in the centre of Birmingham during the day in the week. So I think that actually is possibly the best council permit racket I've ever heard of. But no, look, I mean, the reason why this is a racket is basically two things. Firstly, control parking zones, residence permits, they've spread. You know, it's like a disease. It's like a virus. It just spreads everywhere. You put one somewhere, people go park in the next place that doesn't have one, so it spreads to there, it spreads to there, it spreads to there. Essentially, it all comes from commuters. So it's this desire to stop people parking on the road and then going to the station and getting the train. Now, why this is a racket is because what you've ended up with in a lot of places is all-day parking restrictions, which you don't need to stop commuters. You only need parking restrictions for about 1 or 2 hours in the middle of the day. But all-day parking restrictions are A, more lucrative, and B, also cheaper to run because you don't have to have the traffic wardens going around double-checking whether that car's been there for longer than a certain period of time. You just slap a ticket on it. But the other reason why this is a racket is that most of these things make quite a lot of money from parking fines. Yet also, you have to pay a lot for your residence permit. Now, the whole idea of residence parking is to benefit the residents. The clue is in the name of residence parking. Yet those residents have to pay a lot of money, a sky-high fee, which completely outweighs the cost of running that scheme to the council to park outside their house. But then it's even more of a racket, because if you think about it, whilst there is a cost in setting up a CPZ, a controlled parking zone, once it's there, once you've put the signs in place and you've painted the lines and you've done all that work, there isn't really any other cost. You know, maybe you have to do a little bit of maintenance every year, but it's negligible. So why are the charges going up? Well, the councils are meant to not be able to cash in on this. They say, oh, no, we're not cashing in on it. You know, we can't spend this money on normal things. But they are, really, because why are the charges going up? You know, they already make money from the fines. The fines more than pay for any maintenance every year. So it's a racket. And I have got a vested interest in this because I'm hit by this racket. I live in the London Borough of Islington, which has the fourth most expensive permit in the country at £545. But that is because it grades it on CO2 emissions of your car. And then it also helpfully adds a £96 extra diesel surcharge to cars, which ironically tend to have the lowest CO2 emissions. Got to take your hats off to the council.
And breathe. No tipping for the council. We're close to wrapping up this show, but before we do, any holiday plans coming up? Now remember, do as the Romans do. Don't leave your chopsticks standing up in a bowl in Japan. Definitely don't use your index finger to point at people in Indonesia. And above all, always remember to tip around 10% of the bill, right? Or is it 25? Or none at all? Now that's what we're looking around now. Tipping around the world. Get it wrong and you may not just get a frown. Indeed, for some service workers, it's actually the difference between them getting paid at all. So I want to know a little bit more about your article here. Save us from any potential embarrassment. Rachel, what have you been looking at?
We've looked at what is the norm in different places and that people tend to go on holiday in Spain, in France, Australia, Croatia, and it's all completely different. Definitely, if you're going to one of those places and you fear social embarrassment, it's worth going on to thisismoney.co.uk for a full synopsis of the correct protocol in each country. And the variation is huge. The difference between what would happen to you if you tipped a little bit in Croatia versus if you tipped a little bit in the US.
For example, what would happen in Croatia?
For example, I think everyone would be very happy if you tipped a little bit. And in the US, you would probably get your food spat in.
I think that what this shows is that there is this reputation that you hear about as the English, or the British, sorry, are bad tippers, aren't we? You've heard that before. Mm. Everybody's heard that before. Now, I think that that's very unfair because looking through this, we're talking Italy, Spain, France here. And the thing that shines through with Italy, Spain and France is that basically pretty much all of the service on your restaurant bill is included in the bill and you're not expected to tip. And if you leave a little amount of money, then that's seen as rewarding good service and people are very grateful for it. And I think that British holidaymakers don't realise this and they go around France and Italy and Spain regularly leaving an extra 10% on the bill, so actually tip very generously. So I think that this comes from the Americans and I think that that's a bit unfair because actually in most of the world we're probably quite generous tippers, but we're probably just not so good in the States. And let's face it, the system in the States is pretty awful, isn't it? You underpay your staff and then it's expected to be made up in tips. So I think that this is a great defence for the British around the world.
Blame the Americans. Why not? Editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss, thank you so much for joining us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.